Thank you, sir. Good morning, honorable members and members of the public. I've got the same team as last week. We have not changed. But one thing that we need to mention is that we have revised our presentation slightly to target the issues that we want to talk to differently from last week. So what we've done is see that we've cutting the issues in relation to the topic as opposed to the chapter, so that we can speak to the issues that have been commented upon. And we're not going to go back to some of the aspects that we spoke to already last week, but we'll just maybe emphasize some of the things that we had said as a department. We still need time to consider. For instance, the area of preparation of financial statements. We had a discussion and we had said that the department did not have a conclusive proposal on that. But with further discussions, I think, in the House, we have gone back to now come with a more comprehensive approach to the area of preparation of financial statements. We will take it through in the moment. And like I said last week, Fungai Sibanda will assist me with the presentation. He will deal predominantly with the area relating to business rescue, and I'll just, you know, touch on some of the final aspects of the discussion that we had last week. In relation to the issue of correction of financial freedom, we have initially proposed to exempt personalized companies, owner-managed companies, as well as those companies where the executive directors are also shareholders of the company. So we sought to exempt them from preparation of financial statements. And the idea really was to relieve the burden where it's not necessary for them in terms of the company's act to prepare and produce those financial statements as a matter of their business. But we have now gone back to consider the need why small companies actually prepare financial statements. And we think that it's important for them to do that in order to encourage sound financial management, further to ensure the sustainability of companies of all sizes, because, you know, part of the sustainability of a company could be determined by how they manage their companies financially. And financial statements or preparations thereof would actually guide the companies and probably even make them responsible in terms of how they manage their finances. And thirdly, we just thought that as much as we may propose to relieve them from preparing this financial statement, actually this financial statement may be a requirement in terms of other regulatory requirements or other laws, such as, for instance, maybe for tax purposes, they may be required to actually produce financial statements. So from that perspective, therefore, we're thinking that this could also assist the with compliance with those regulatory requirements, where we then, you know, make it as something that is standard in their businesses that they should have them prepared. So we have considered those benefits, and we're thinking that we always talk about entrepreneurship and the need to encourage entry in various markets, but we also think that yes, it's also important that we also ensure sustainability through proper financial management and also encourage companies to be good corporate citizens in terms of how they manage companies and how they keep their books and how they report their finances in the process. However, the one thing that we thought that would then go a long way in reducing the burden or even the cost associated with preparation of financial statements, we decided that, or we're proposing that, as Although we require them to have the financial statements prepared, we will not require them to have them audited or independently reviewed. So the only time that they will be required to audit their statement is if they are they decide to do that themselves, or where they are required by an administrative notice made issued by the commission to lift the exemption from them. And then in that case, then they may be required to produce to have the financial statement audited or independently reviewed, depending on the size of the company and the requirement that is attached to them in terms of reviewing or auditing. So we then say that, you know, I think this basically achieves the purpose that we initially wanted to achieve, to say we want to reduce the burden on those companies that should not be burdened with preparation of financial. But I think in our initial proposal, we perhaps a bit misguided in that actually they are required to prepare this financial statement to comply with other requirements. So we're not necessarily reducing that burden to the extent that will show a difference. So I think that's why we have reconsidered our position and we should know that they should be required to produce. Then we come to the issue of financial reporting standards. In the first stage of the presentations submissions that were made in the public hearing, a lot of comments were made in this area, and in particular, it was in regarding to the role of the reporting, the financial reporting standard council. We want to just make it clear in terms of how we see this council operating and what its role should be. This council, in our view, should play a role of determining the form and content of financial reporting to ensure simplicity and accountability. And we're thinking that for them to also be in a position to align properly to those international standards, that they should hold membership of the International Accounting Standards Board. This particular role is not different, you know, from the corporate law amendment that we did a few years ago. Some of the commentators, in particular, I think it was the JSE, that suggested that this role is not consistent with what we had in the corporate laws amendment, in the sense that they wanted the reporting standards council to be a council that will set the standards and issue them. But at the same time, they wanted to have legal basis to these standards. So I think the principle here is that you can choose to have a situation where reporting standards become a voluntary thing, or when you require legal basis, then you would have them issued by the minister. So those are the two things that you need to distinguish when you come to a decision as to whether or not to give legal basis. Because when you give legal basis to a particular function, then it has to be issued in terms of regulation by the minister. So in that case, we think that the approach that we are taking in this bill is consistent with the approach that was taken in the corporate laws amendment, that the role of the council will be predominantly advisory, in a sense that it will research, it will consult, and adapt the international standards to our local needs and advise the minister of their specific. And then once the minister is satisfied about that, then the minister will then issue those standards as a regulation. Then the other issue that arises from that process, which was raised as a concern, was the speed with which the minister would be in a position to issue those, because when the standards change internationally, it's important for the local standards to adapt immediately after that change.
And so the concern was that between the time when the standards change and the time when the minister issues the regulation, there may be time constraints that may actually result in a South African company not complying to intellectual standards because we would not have existed the standards that are required in the time that sufficiently allows for incorporation. But we're thinking that this concern around the timing is being resolved by Section 223 of the bill, which then says that once the council has consulted and researched and advised the minister of suitability, the minister, if he's satisfied, he will issue those standards as regulations in the government gazette without necessarily publishing them for comments first, because that process would have happened at the council level. So we're thinking that concern around time will be resolved by that, because then if it was subjected to the normal process of the issuing of publishing of regulations in the government gazette, where it would be required for the entity that issues or publishes those regulations to give the public a time to comment, you know, which may be a period from 6 weeks to 2 months. So that may actually be an issue in relation to the reporting council. So now we've made a specific provision that takes out the publishing from the normal requirements so that the minister can issue them directly if he's satisfied of the standard that's proposed by the council. So we're thinking that there's no deviation there from the initial intention on the part of the department and also on the part of the legislature in at the time when the corporate laws amendment were adopted. So there isn't any deviation from that. The third aspect that was also I think commented on significantly was the area of auditing. Auditing as it relates to the role of the audit committee, as well as auditing as it relates to the function of the auditors of the company. The third part really in relation to the appointment of the audit committee, there was a discussion in relation to whether the board or the shareholder must appoint the audit committee. And the approach of the department is that the shareholder must appoint the audit committee as a subcommittee of the board. I think concerns that were raised were not really objecting to the principle and the role of the audit committee and its reporting line. You know, there weren't significant concerns around that. But the concern was that if you allow the shareholders to be the ones appointing the audit committee, then that they will make what could be said to be political appointments. And our view is that we think shareholders, if they are credible enough to appoint the board, then they should be credible enough to appoint the audit committee that should be a subcommittee of the board. And we don't think that they would make appointments that are less of the standard that is required of an audit committee. And we think that approach should still remain in the act. And in relation to the reporting of the audit committee, we're thinking that the audit committee's report must and will be included in the annual financial statements of the company. And that is provided for in the act. And obviously the annual financial statements of the company will include the director's report and also the audit committee's report. So the shareholders will have a sense of what the report of the audit committee is. So they'll report directly through the financial statement to the shareholders. And we also think that where the shareholders feel that the audit committee member, or rather maybe the chair of that audit committee, should be present at the AGM or the annual general meeting to respond to some of the issues that they may seek clarity on, then that should not be precluded, that such can happen. And further to that, you know, as a consequence of the decision that we are proposing here in relation to the appointment of the audit committee. We're thinking that there's also a need to provide in the Act that any vacancies that arise in the audit committee should be filled by the shareholders as well. That so the power to appoint on or to fill any vacancy should still rest with the shareholders. We're thinking that that, that approach is still in line with what we're seeking to achieve here, especially in relation to the role of shareholders as well as their right to have certain aspects of the company as transparent as they would like to have it. The appointment of the auditors in this area, there was the way a number of submissions that suggested that the liability of auditors must be limited in this bill. As a department, we believe that the intention of this bill is not to to make any amendment to the Auditors Professions Act. The issue of liability of auditors is dealt with sufficiently in the Auditors Professions Act. And we have no intention of amending that legislation through this bill. So it is for that reason that we're thinking that the bill should remain the same and it should not limit any liabilities of the liability of the auditors, and that this bill must not allow a situation where auditors could then contract out of their responsibility or liability, which are catered for in terms of the Auditors Professions Act. A further issue that was commented upon was the issue of rotation of the auditors for a period of 5 financial years. We're saying that that is still in order, that the rotation should take place on a 5-year financial year basis, but that the cooling off period rather be reduced to 2 years instead of 5 years as proposed here. I think we touched on this issue slightly last week. And also, there was also a proposal that maybe the rotation would not be that much possible in certain remote areas where there isn't a lot of auditors, and that maybe, you know, certain areas could be excluded from the rotation. At this point, we do not believe that there's sufficient basis for us to create exemptions based on geographic areas. So we're thinking that this, upon implementation, I think one would then be in a position to review the difficulties, but at this point we don't anticipate any such difficulties. It would defeat the purpose of the principle that we're trying to put here, that the auditor's role must be that of somebody that oversees and ensures the independence and the transparency of the company and ensure that the company complies with certain things, and that where auditors have picked on certain risk areas, that the companies mitigate those risks. So that level of independence must be there. And we're thinking that the rotation will also go a long way to actually advance the aspect of independence. And we believe that at this point we should not create any exemption from it. Based on geographic basis. I think this would be the last part that I'll be presenting for this morning, which relates to shareholder protection. You'll notice that these were the issues that were raised mainly by Henny from a perspective of a foreign investor. And also in the submission, I think the sentiment that this bill seeks to erode the rights of shareholders. And we're going to just show some of the concessions that we're seeking to make here, but also that in some areas where there's proposed changes, we don't think there's a need for such changes as they are already catered for in the bill. The first aspect really is that Hemings had raised a concern that requiring 25% of shareholders to support a demand for a meeting, or 25% of the voting rights to support a demand for a meeting by a shareholder, may be slightly high and may discourage, you know, or at least or erode the role of shareholders on in respect of companies. And we've agreed with them in that sense, and we said that yeah, maybe the threshold is too high. But initially, we didn't think it actually is a problem because the provision also provides for the MOI to accommodate a lesser or to change that 25% to a lesser percentage. But in our discussion, we then realized that in fact, when you're putting a 25% threshold, often in practice, that 25%, even if the MOA could allow you an opportunity to change it and put it at a lower point, but normal people would take what's in the legislation as the minimum requirement, and they'll always work around that. So we think that yes, maybe to that extent, yes, the 25% may be high to the extent that it could be taken or interpreted as a minimum. So we think that we will then propose that the 25% be reduced to 10% to accommodate that at least shareholders, when they demand a meeting, we should not require too much, you know, in terms of voting rights to support such a demand for a meeting. So 10% should be appropriate. And further to that, Section 53.3 in the bill seems to be taking away the right to abstain in a meeting, you know, from voting. What the provision provides for is that if you don't vote in a meeting, if you don't decide to exercise your right to vote for or against, and you abstain, that right not to vote that you've taken would then be taken to be a vote against that particular motion. And we're thinking that this deviates from the principle that is practiced on a daily basis, that a person has the right to abstain from voting, and we should not take that away. And we're thinking that this was unintended, and that it should be corrected, such that when you abstain, it should be recorded as abstinence, and it should not be counted as a vote against. Also, the concern relating to the memorandum of incorporation eroding shareholder protection is, we think that it's a bit unfounded. In the comments from Hemming on that particular point, they basically seem to say that the memorandum of incorporation seems to be taking a lot away from the shareholders. But we don't think it's the case, because the memorandum of incorporation can only be amended, revised, only by approval of the shareholders. The directors cannot by themselves amend the MOI. They cannot by themselves do that. It will still require. They can only propose to the shareholders, and the shareholders must then approve any such amendment. So now to suggest that, you know, the MOI in itself, you know, as an incorporating document, erodes shareholders' protection, I think it suggests that the shareholders have no role whatsoever in the MOI, and we don't believe that's true. So we think that that's a bit unfounded on that basis, that actually shareholders have a bigger role to play in relation to the MOI. Okay, a further issue here is in relation to, I think this is a consequence as well of some of the policies that we've taken, that the powers to remove a member of the board must rest with the shareholders. I think in the bill there's suggestions that the board can remove one of the directors if they are of the view that he's a disqualified person or he's a delinquent or any of those things that that suggests that he's not fit and proper to be on the board. It suggests that the board could actually remove that person, and it doesn't seem to directly relate that as something that actually is a function of the shareholder. The board may report that to the shareholders, but the shareholders should be the ones making a decision to remove that particular shareholder at the end of the day. But what we think is that the board has a responsibility to ensure that such instance of where a company is not fit and proper is made known to the shareholders, for the shareholders to trigger the relevant processes. But also in terms of this bill, you know, a director may not be a director if he's disqualified for any reason. So automatically, you know, effectively, they would not be on the board legally because the Act prohibits them to be on the board. But to suggest that the board can remove them, that person, without any due process that is being followed to allow the shareholders to remove that person formally, may lead to disastrous, I think, or unintended consequences. In that regard, I'm thinking about a situation where some director could be removed based on malicious allegations which may not have been proven, and it turns out that they actually are not necessarily disqualified. Because what the process in the Act is saying, in the bill is saying, is that where the board, the director has been removed by the board for any of those reasons, then such director or the person that appointed that director would have to approach the court to review that determination. We're thinking that in the case of, you know, where you've been probably maliciously removed, or where the reason for removing you was misguided, or there was misleading information, it puts a huge burden on the director now to approach the court when the director has actually been removed by his peers on the board. So we're thinking that role of removing the director must rest with the shareholder, because the right process would then be followed. So we're thinking that at least it will deal with some of the unintended consequences that could arise where a director is removed, maybe on unsound basis. So the other aspect that we touched on slightly last week was that in terms of the bill, where a quorum is required in a meeting and that quorum is not met, it is suggested that for you to have the quorum at the next meeting, if there's no quorum, you need to approach the court for the court to say that yes, you can be able to share the quorum. We're thinking that deviates from the current provisions of the Companies Act, and saying that where there's no quorum, the members that were present at that meeting, the meeting will be adjourned, the members that were present at that adjourned meeting will then form the quorum at the next meeting if there's no quorum. They will be deemed to form a quorum at that meeting, at the next meeting. So we're thinking that this is consistent with what practice is at the moment, and also what it is that the current 1973 Act provided for. And from the Hemis comments again, there was a proposal that preemptive rights should also be extended to apply to public companies. The comment was basically saying that we seem to limit the preemptive rights in relation to shares. We seem to be limiting it to private companies and not extending it to public companies as well as state-owned companies. And that they propose that we extend that. Other departments, we think that to upfront allow preemptive rights to apply to public companies could actually undermine the principle of public companies having to offer their shares to the public. And preemptive rights basically talk to the situation where if I'm a shareholder of a company and I want to sell my shares, that I may be required, if they are preemptive rights, I may be required to offer them, I would be required to offer them to the existing shareholders before I can offer them to the public. So we think that works well in a private company scenario. But in a public company scenario where public offerings are something that is encouraged and something that forms the base of public companies, we're thinking that to allow a blanket preemptive right to be applied in that may actually undermine that particular principle of public companies. So in that case, we think that as much as the proposal by Hemis, I think things to be okay, we're saying that actually the bill already provides for that, because the bill says that the public companies would not be allowed, you know, to have preemptive rights. Only, but that can only happen if they provide for something like that to happen in their memorandum of incorporation. So we're saying that if companies or shareholders such as Hemi want to allow for that to apply to their company as a public company, they must provide for that in their memorandum of incorporation. If they have not provided for that, then it will not apply automatically. It will mean they are precluded from having those rights extended in public companies. So we think that, yes, if that's what they want, the Act does not preclude them completely from doing that, but it becomes an exception to the rule. And that exception would be then exercised through incorporation in the memorandum of incorporation. The other concern that they raised is that when we talk about the threshold that is required for ordinary resolutions and special resolutions, in relation to ordinary resolutions, we think that you require 50 plus, or at least more than 50% of the vote to pass an ordinary resolution. And in relation to the special resolution, we proposing that you would require 75% of the vote. And in the bill, we then also provide that through the memorandum of incorporation, the company could decide to increase or to set the threshold at a particular level for ordinary shares. It could set it at any amount from 50 to between 50 and 65. And then also that in relation to the special resolution, it could also decide on a specific amount of the shares that would be, of the voting rights that would be required, from 75 to any other number. So it can either increase or decrease that. So we allow for that scope in the bill. But then Hemis seems again to suggest that also is not appropriate, and that it may also just also result in the erosion of the protection of shareholders. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the principle that we've spoken about around the MOI not to be viewed as a separate document that shareholders have a say on, in fact, final say on. I think it's inappropriate that it's viewed in a manner that an MOI would be something that the directors could decide to change anytime when they feel it's appropriate. We're thinking that it's actually the shareholders that have a final say. And we're saying that that scope is still appropriate, and that it should not be amended. So that proposal by him, we're thinking that it should not be considered for any amendment, as it is appropriate. And the last aspect really is in relation to their comment on the director's indemnity. In this case, they are proposing that the provisions of Section 73A3, they are saying that they are sort of incomplete, but we've gone through that provision again, and we're thinking that it is complete. In that sense, they had said that that directors should not be indemnified should they be found to be in breach of their duties. We think that this principle or concept that they are proposing here is actually catered for in that Section 78, because there it specifically says the instances where a company could be allowed or could indemnify a director for litigation costs, for instance. It says that it could cover those in the case where maybe the proceedings against the director is abandoned, so obviously there's no guilty finding there, then they should cover their expenses. They are allowed to indemnify the director. So we think that I think what Yemis is proposing actually is catered for in that section, and that there's no need to amend the section or even to add to it at this point. Thank you very much. I'll just hand over to Fungai to just address the area of business rescue through you, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I think one of the most significant and novel introductions into our company legislation is the concept of business rescue. And it builds really on the current judicial management system and the tools on it. However, there is this temptation to always want to equate business rescue to liquidation. And we want to really emphasize the point that the two are different, their objectives are different, their purposes are different. But there is always that temptation, and a lot of the comments that we received, especially from Labour, I think were sort of premised on the idea that business rescue really should proceed from the same perspective or premise as liquidation, and in our view, probably that shouldn't be the case. The concept of business rescue obviously is designed to provide a mechanism for rescuing a company that is facing financial difficulties, and it is realized or recognized that there are good prospects for that company to be rescued, and that particular company really has not reached the stage of insolvency. Actually, the bill says that a company may not adopt a resolution to place itself under a business rescue if it has already adopted a resolution for liquidation, or once it is under business rescue, it may not adopt a resolution for liquidation up until the business rescue process is finalized. So that goes to show that really the two processes are different and they may not run concurrently. So, Chair, the bill, therefore, as the committee has it before, it is not intended to deal with insolvency. And during our deliberations in the drafting stages, we did engage with the Department of Justice, and we came to that agreement and understanding that the company's bill will deal with business rescue, and that the Insolvency Act will deal with the issue of litigation. So there is that understanding between us and the Department of Justice. Although a lot of commentators say that business rescue should fall under the Insolvency Act, we think that it will be displaced, really, if it is under the Insolvency Act. As we have already indicated, the two deal with different issues. But we also recognize the fact that Section 128 defines financially distressed company in a way perhaps that might give a connotation that is actually similar to an insolvent company, especially paragraph F1, which says that a company is financially distressed if it's not able to pay its dues, or if it's not able to pay its debt as they call due, or if its liabilities are greater than its assets. And that definition really goes to the heart of insolvency. We think that we will be amending that definition so that there's a clear distinction. However, the other two parts, F2 and F3, we think they are okay because they talk about the prospect of the company being able to meet its debt in a future day, 6 months from that particular moment. So, Chair, the point really that we are making here is that insolvency business rescue should really be distinguished and separated. The second issue that we want to talk about or emphasize is that speed in this whole process is really of great effect, as was indicated by Professor Chen last week. And as you also note from the bill that there are certain set time frames within which certain decisions have to be made. For instance, once a company has adopted a resolution, within 5 business days, it has to notify each and every affected stakeholder. If it doesn't do that, then the resolution lapses. After 10 days, a supervisor must be appointed, you know. After 3 months, the business risk process must be completed. So there are certain time frames in the bill for certain things to happen. And if those time frames are not adhered to, it then compromises the whole business rescue process, because this company is really in financial difficulties and needs to be rescued as soon as possible. So time and speed are really crucial in that process. There were two concerns raised by two different commentators. The one said that it appears as if the supervisor is given too much power in the bill to make certain decisions. The other commentator said, well, it appears that the supervisor is not given enough power to make the necessary decisions. So this really goes to show the kind of balancing act that we need to strike between different competing interests. But in our view, we do believe that the supervisor is given appropriate power to make certain decisions, to control the business rescue process, including the power to suspend certain transactions and claims temporarily. So we think that the powers that are accorded to the supervisor in the bill are adequate and are appropriate to enable the supervisor to make those types of decisions. There was also a concern that the appointment of the supervisor should be made concurrent or jointly rather by all affected stakeholders. There are two ways to initiate a business rescue process. On the one hand, a company may voluntarily adopt a resolution to place itself under business rescue, and that resolution can be adopted either by the board of directors or by the shareholder. Now, again, or rather, the second way of placing a business under or a company under business rescue is when an affected person applies to court. An affected person could either be a creditor or a trade union applying to court and making a claim that this company is financially distressed, and then the court will assess and see whether there is a prospect for this company to be rescued, and if so, then the business will be placed under a rescue proceeding. Where a company voluntarily places itself under business rescue, it also appoints a supervisor. And I think the concern was that appointment of the supervisor should be done jointly with other affected stakeholders. But there is a process for the affected stakeholders, like your creditors and employees, to actually object to the appointment of a supervisor if they feel that the supervisor so appointed is not qualified or is not proper, or if they feel that there is no prospect really for the business to be rescued, they can object to the appointment of the supervisor. However, if the company is placed under business rescue as a result of application by a creditor or a trade union, then they may also make a recommendation for the appointment of the supervisor. Otherwise, the supervisor is appointed by the affected stakeholder. So we think that the bill balances the two, depending on who files for business rescue. If it's the company itself, then it's appointed the supervisor. If it's an affected stakeholder, then they make that appointment of the supervisor through the court. We don't think that the appointment of the supervisor should be done jointly, because we are saying that speed is of effect. So now, if all affected parties were to sit down and say, who should be the supervisor here, they won't come to an agreement, really. and the business will continue to deteriorate. So we think that the scheme has provided for you to be probably the best. So say if you have filed for a court application as an affected stakeholder, you may appoint a supervisor. If it's the company itself, then you may appoint a supervisor. Then there was also a concern that since business rescue is a new concept, where are we going to find people to act as supervisors? And our response, Trey, that, well, we believe that this proper professional will evolve with time. We think there are people out there that would rather possess the necessary skills, be it financial management, administration, or whatever general skills are needed for one to enter the supervisor. We think that those skills are available out there. Needless to say that in the National Credit Act, we actually introduced the whole concept of debt counseling. Again, there were not debt counselors in the country. But as we speak today, the National Credit Regulator is trained hundreds of people as debt counselors, and they are doing a marvelous job in counseling people that are in financial difficulties. So in a similar vein, we think that a supervisor in a business review environment will also evolve. They will be trained, they will evolve over time. There was also a concern from labor that the claims that arise, especially from workers, should be treated equally. Because the bill says that claims will be treated in the order in which they were cared. And to the extent that probably this is not aligned with the Insolvency Act or the International Labour Organization Convention, we will amend it accordingly so that workers' claims are treated equally. And also we'll look into the question of the preferred ranking of employee claims. So if we don't really have an intention to come up with provisions that will conflict or that will not be aligned with other laws, so to the extent that we can make those alignments, we will. The other issue related to the development of a business rescue plan, that it needs to be done in consultation with other affected stakeholders, including creditors and trade unions. Again, we want to emphasize that if that is the case, if the business rescue plan is developed in consultation with affected stakeholders, it may affect the time within which it is really completed. However, the bill in section 150 provides that the business rescue plan will be developed, or rather will be put in place after consultation with other affected stakeholders. In other words, the supervisor is mandated to consult affected stakeholders. But the finalization of the business rescue plan need not necessarily be agreed upon by all affected stakeholders. But after consulting, then the supervisor may finalize the business plan. Otherwise, it may never get finalized. The other concern was that the supervisor's report should point to any misconduct on the part of directors, perhaps that led to the company being in financial difficulty, because that report should be given to the trade union. The bill does provide that a copy of the report will be provided to affected stakeholders. So we think that the concern raised by labor is covered in section 141D of the that report will be made available to the clergy. There was also an issue around the definition of pension scheme that it seems to, or rather the treatment of pension scheme seems not to include provident scheme. And perhaps that's a technical amendment that we may defend into the bill so that the pension, the definition of pension scheme also includes provident fund. The last aspect related to voting by interest, and Labour was proposing that voting should be based on numbers instead of voting interest. And we think that that may really give us some challenges as to the practicality, and we want to maintain the voting by interest as currently provided for. Then the next area relates to access to information. One of the contentions again made by Labour is that if they are to participate in the business rescue process, they need to have access to information. And we do concede that Labour could be given limited access to company financial statements for purposes of initiating business rescue. Share their challenges around accessing company information, challenges of confidentiality and the like, and therefore any access to such information really should be limited, it should be conditional, and we think that it should be provided through the company commission under very strict conditions. And a general comment was also made that the current section 26 seems to limit access to company information to holders of security. In other words, if you are not the holder of security in a particular company, you may not be given access to or even access certain information. And we realize that the current Act, section 113, does actually provide access to the public to certain information, for instance, a list of shareholders, the actual shareholders in a particular company, or a list of directors and the like. And we think that that section we should actually just transform it into the company bill so that the public does have certain access to certain information and can't be provided. It's really not taking anything away or anything, anything. But we think that the public should be given access to information as currently provided for. Under whistleblowing, you will note that section 159 provides that information may be given to certain groups, be it the company's commission, be it the board of directors, the company's members, and the like. Now, a suggestion or a proposal was made that people should also disclose information to trade unions, to the media, and the like, for purposes of whistleblowing. However, we thought that perhaps that would be taking the issue of whistleblowing too far, because we don't think that really disclosing such information to other groups, you know, other than those that are listed in the Act, in the bill, might assist the process. The groups that are mentioned there are people or are stakeholders who actually have certain decision-making power. If I disclose information to the company's members or to the company's commission or to the board of directors, they may act based on that information. However, if I disclose certain information to say, for instance, the media, it's not quite clear how that information may be treated. And remember that the purpose of leading office is to make sure that that information is followed up and acted upon. So we would want to restrict the type of stakeholders that may be approved for purposes of disclosure or for purposes of telling on what is happening in a particular company. And the next issue relates to the definition of confidential information, that the bill does not define what confidential information is. And we do realize that other legislation, for instance, the Confidential Act, does define what confidential information is, and we may want to take a leap from that and define confidential information in this bill. Chair, I'll hand over to the Weta.
Thank you.
I think in conclusion, there's just a number of issues that we through the review of all the comments that came up just as general comments, and we thought that we could just deal with them here in the last slide. The one issue that came out strongly is really the how this bill speaks to the principles that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. And I think the sentiments that were expressed by the commentators at the time made a lot of sense. But we also view that, in fact, maybe that's something that we didn't consider initially, but that, in fact, most of the legislation that is passed in South Africa, especially post-94, the preamble of each one of this legislation would always make reference to the Constitution and the principles that enshrine and the spirit that of the Bill of Rights, and that such would also govern the implementation of the particular legislation. And we think that may have been an omission in this particular bill. And we don't think that it's something that cannot be dealt with. We think that it can still be accommodated. And also that in some instances you find that in the application or in the interpretation of the legislation, there's always reference to that this legislation would be subject to the Constitution, so that is expressed strictly. But we don't believe as a department that it's necessary when we now talk about the duties of the directors in relation to corporate governance to then make a further addition to the adherence to the Bill of Rights and all of that. We're thinking that those are the requirements that in any event the companies are supposed to comply with as required in terms of the Constitution. So we don't need to incorporate those principles specifically in various sections of the Act, but we can refer to them in the application or also in the preamble of the legislation, such that is also given acknowledgement and cognizance, but that it doesn't actually add or take away the right and the responsibility to actually comply with the Constitution from any of the companies that are being regulated here. So this basically responds to that presentation, and I, you know, coming from a human rights background, I felt that was kind of an interesting presentation and something that is sometimes overlooked. And I agree that, in fact, to create prominence and to raise awareness, and you need to make reference in at least in the legislation to the Constitution. And sorry. Okay. Also, the other issue that came up was that, you know, in various sections of this bill, we make reference to the regulations to be issued or published by the minister, but there's a concern that these regulations, people don't know what they look like. They don't know what they're going to entail. you know, for companies to be able to prepare for compliance with this legislation, they need to know at least what it is that is expected of them. And there was that sentiment that says that these regulations must be up, they must be finalized, they must be issued by the minister at the time when this act comes into force. And we agree with that. And in fact, that is the plan in the department, that these regulations will be widely consulted and would then, by the time this bill comes into effect, the necessary regulations would also be completed. So it's something that we will also agree with. And also in the bill, you'll notice that there are pages that talk to the forms and other things that really are issues that are best placed in the regulations. Those things will be dealt with in the regulations going forward. So we say here that the amendment to that should not necessarily be the domain of Parliament. It should be things that should rest with the minister. For instance, if we need to change forms, I mean, those things are things that clearly should be sitting in the regulations for the minister to then issue those regulations relating to the forms. So we're just emphasizing that part, that these are things that will be dealt with in the regulations going forward. The other aspect that has been brought to our attention is that the current bill doesn't make provision for the registration of defensive names. Registration of defensive names really relates to where you want to register the names of a company or the names that are associated with the names of the company to protect them from use by other people. So currently there's a process for registering those defensive names, and this bill does not carry that forward. And we think that there's probably a need to still carry that concept forward, and then to the extent that it's still relevant, we'll then take it on board. The other aspect that seems to be omitted from the bill is really how the agencies that are going to be created are going to be funded. I think we think it's very necessary and important that the manner in which these agencies could raise money or the manner in which they're going to receive their funding, it must be in the bill, such that we don't find ourselves in a situation where agencies receive money from other sources and sources that could be controversial or anything. So we want to make it specific and consistent with all the other agencies that we've created through any other legislation here in Parliament. So we're thinking that this is an amendment that we're going to make just to make sure that is clear, because it seems to be an omission in the bill. And the other grammatical and syntactic errors that we have also been alerted to through all these public hearings, because as we've mentioned when we started our presentation last week, is that we have not sought to bring to this house the technical amendments that people have proposed. Those ones that are technical, we will then go through the act with the advice of the state law advisors to see how we then effect those changes. And like you said, most of the technical comments that have been made are actually valid. Some ways where the subways are missing, and some ways they're not phrased in a manner that says that what needs to be said, and maybe a different term could be useful in that regard. And the last part, obviously, is really the comment that was made that the use of the word upward in the bill is a bit misleading, because, you know, when you think about an upward, normally you're thinking about something different from what is envisaged here. And so we think that to the extent that this term may not be appropriate, because it may be misleading in a way, we propose to change it. Although we have not decided on what the better term would be, there are various options, obviously. You could refer to them as a tribunal. You can refer to them as something that reflects the adjudicative role of that particular tribunal, sorry, particular order. But we concede that it may actually be misleading, and that's the error that we reflect. This really brings us to the end of the presentation, and like you say, there are some of the questions that were raised last week that we then sought to respond to in a way through this presentation as repackaged. And then there are other comments that were made by the members last week. In particular, there was a comment that was made by, I think it's honorable member Ms. Happy Singh, in relation to the role of the commission in proactively initiating a business review. That's something that we said we'd take back and just check if it's something that may be important or necessary to incorporate, and whether it would not be covered under the functions of the commission in general. The concern that was raised by honourable member Tabitha was that in most cases, especially in those sectors that are labour intensive, the companies may not recognise that they require rescue, but that it should be in the interest of the economy, the interest of the workers, that where the commission, during their monitoring, realizes that this company may actually require rescue, that there must be some proactive action on the part of the commission to initiate rescue, or to at least recommend to the board of that company to initiate the rescue process. So that's the area that we said we will then take back and consider. And in our consideration, we think that the functions of the commission really allow for the commission to proactively recommend certain things to the companies, mm-hmm. and we think that could form one of those issues. And to the extent that is not sufficient, obviously we would accept any suggestions from the other members where possible. Thanks, Chair. I think we'll take questions, and if there are other things that we just want to highlight as well, which we may have omitted, we'll just use that during this process.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Thank you, Colonel Gaspar. Members, comments, questions? Comment anyone, if I can?
Thank you, Chair. Ma'am, I just want to, I don't want to hop on this thing, but this question of this rural disadvantage of small companies in particular is a reality. Is there some way that I'm on page 5? Is there some way that we could insert something that says that certain instances could be fixed on that? I just thought that one should think about it, but it's a real problem. We are already battling with situations where small businesses hardly get to a decent order. And now if the law insists that this thing should be changed every 5 years, and then somebody would have to go 200-300 kilometers to get a to be serviced by an order, that could be problematic in the long run. I just want to put it back onto the table. And then the whole question of after consultation as opposed to in consultation. I'm extremely biased to this particular thing because I am coming from the state in and I know what businesses normally do when they have a choice plan. Either there's a genuine sense of rescuing the business or there's a sense of having to get out. Whatever the case may be, as long as I get my benefits, then I want to get out. In the end of the day, it is obviously workers that are losing in the end. And I have been involved in a lot of stuff. Currently, I'm busy as a member of parliament in assisting with companies currently that in similar situations. Of course, with the assistance, with the unions there. And there's a process of consultation. Because at the end, it's like, the table is laid. And there's nothing anymore because we've consulted. And now we say we consult. There's nothing anybody can do about it. And I must say, my experience of late with business, or particularly labor, is that given the economic problems that we currently facing in our country, there is a genuine desire, some instances where I have experience, is that labor is very genuine desire to resolve business, to rescue business rather than fighting for the trend to pay a package of energy. So I'm just very concerned about the after consultation and the post consultation rate. Pleasure.
Thank you, Comrade Kenny. Dr. Rajesh.
Still coming. First and foremost, Chairman, I think it, when it comes to appointing supervisors, I think it's also very important to take the culture of the specific business is also very important. I think that with due respect to the Chairman, and to run a retail with a retail business is very much different from a manufacturing one. So I think it's very important that the supervisor has the technical and the practical experience that they have to turn the business around. I think that's extremely important. And then the second thing, Chairman, the whole idea of the definition regarding confidential information, I think that's very important for the committee also to take note of that. And I think it's I appeal to the department to really make their definition as broad as possible, but also to include, I mean, business strategies, for example, and all these other particular things, because business today, Chairman, is a very competitive field. And to retain a competitive edge these days, I think you must be allowing particular firms to use research and R&D and so forth to let them or allow them to increase their market share. That's, these are the two things from our point of view, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Dr. Adam, thank you. I'm going to thank you.
Thanks, I must say I'm glad that the issue of the conference formulation of regulations has been taken into account. It's very helpful. And I trust also, although usually regulations are just, you know, gazetted to quite a great extent, that Parliament would be roped in this instance because of the significance attached to this piece of legislation. Chair, let me start with the financial statement. I think also that the department is taking that into account, obviously. We will see when the law is implemented, the extent to which that can help on sustainability. Number two, around the audit committee and auditors, you know, recently I have been exposed, particularly from the public sector side, that the term audit has rather been expanded. The PC, I just discovered yesterday that audit is not defined here, defined in the Audit Profession Act, if I'm correct. But to quite an extent, you know, what I learned was that audit, by audit committee, the one which was involved, which was a secondary one company, is expanded to considering performance, you know, considering policies, the applicability system, and so forth. Something that I maintain, it goes beyond merely looking at financing, you know, compliance. That was very, very interesting because we had to look into operations, of course, relating them to compatibility with the policies and value for money, which was obviously looking at the finances as well. So, it would be helpful if the department would just, you know, help us to the extent to which they are taking into account the expanded or the recent expanded definition of audit, or whether they are, you know, maintaining conventional, you know, definition. And I speak with their crook, you know, limping, because unfortunately I didn't have privy to the actual definition of the term as recently as it may have been. The department is proposing that a series of vacancies in the audit committee be done by shareholders. Now, meet me before an AGM, a member of the audit committee resigned. How that be done? Well, of course, I'm proposing that you tell us that, you know, such appointments or filling of vacancies that to be done speed in order to maintain efficiency in a company. Let me take up also the issue of the decline in give exemption to the principle of rotation. Mine is just to get clarity. Is my understanding correct that focus here is obviously on companies that are obliged by statute to provide audited financial statements? Remember, we're just talking about expanding, you know, financial management accountability, that is, in essence, financial statements, literally to every business. But now, as a project, I thought that was the focus here. We discussed Section 71 around the power to remove members of the board. I'd like to take up, you know, a different approach there, or maybe just to get clarity in what Mr. Dooley was saying. What I understand that there are provisions around stated in Section 71. The due process is that if one is a disqualified director, for example, and has not been, or has managed to slip through the system, not been discovered, would it be appropriate that the board has got the, is given the space to dispense with the removal of that director, because that is provided in the statute. To me, that's different from someone who, being a member of directors, conducts himself or herself in a manner that undermines the prospects or the welfare of the company. In which I do believe that it would warrant the attention of the shareholders. I hope you pick up the distinction, my distinction between the two. You know, and even in terms of the disqualification, I don't think we think of a situation before the appointment. Someone who slipped through the whole vetting, you know, process and is discovered thereafter that the person should have actually declined that was able to slip through. On business rescue, my first question would be, is there sufficient distinction between supervisor and liquidator? There is quite a lot of discussion around that. And also, let me just take up an interesting issue which was presented in one of the submissions, where the term supervisor is also equated to corporate rescue practitioner. Because it seems to me that sounds a little bit more descriptive of the function. Of course, as a commentary, I think I do concur with the department that there needs to be a strong emphasis on the distinction between the rescue mechanism and the insolvency. But I would like to draw the attention to sections 155.2 and 7b.2. That was just once again running through the act again. Reference was made to insolvency there. Okay, to save time, one look at the institution. But it seems there seems to be a risk once again to link that this rescue to insolvency activities. If not, that the department can just clarify on those issues. Around the issue of consultation, there is a light as to what Honorable Oliphant has said. As the department is proposing there that the adoption should be after consultation, not in consultation. Does that mean he's saying that the supervisor assumes a higher authority during the process of implementing the rescue plan? I think I'll comment here after I've got that response. Because obviously, after or during or in consultation, also has an implication of the level of authority that the supervisor may have in implementing this. Now, the voting by interest versus by number. I think, let me just sneak in a proposal that at some stage you need to acknowledge that the process of the corporate law reform is a project and you should look at it in that way rather than just a one-off overhauling an act. Because also, whilst out at this stage in time, concede this, but I really would like us to go back to it because I may not be approaching this, my difference on this through numbers, but I'm looking at the socio-economic impact of those numbers. You might say that I want to vote according to the interest, but I'll say that if I want to vote according to the socio-economic impact of my group interest, how about that? But of course, I speak with caution, Chair, because we need to come to a conclusion of the deal at some stage. But I really want this to be flagged and be taken up, even if it's down the line. Come to Section 7, I think, in page 106, whereby the proposal has got to be endorsed by the Supreme Court. I mean, it's got to be taken to court. I'm just proposing something. What about the role of Supreme Court? Or the CIPRO when it's a commission, but you know, the proposal is endorsed, you know. Why take it to court? Does it need that kind of status? I'm sure bigger minds could help us there. Section 7, page 106. Access to information, Chair. Just as a matter of interest, what about the LRA provision? Are they more in terms of providing access to unions, or are they less than this? Just out of interest. Liberty Act. Because our assumption was that the access to company information is also provided according to the Act. If I'm correct, so you have on that. When it comes to whistleblowing, you say you're excluding trade unions to disclosure Well, I'll focus on trade unions. They're not one of the most direct or intimate stakeholders. My assumption is that at least they should be considered, because trade unions don't just come in. They have a specific interest to defend the interests of their members. I'm not sure about media. Media is a South African situation driven by profit. No matter what you can say about journalism, that I consider, but media as a whole, companies that control and own papers are driven by profit. So I'm putting that aside and I'm making a clear and equivocal truth, you know, that but to me, if the trade union who represent a worker who got an interest. The department is talking about funding of agencies, but makes a political statement, unfortunately. I thought they at least, as bureaucrats, they would give us the facts and figures. How do they propose it? Funding of agencies. Could be of interest, because also we do concur. We don't just legislate, we must also see how it deploys resources to ensure that the legislation becomes effective, particularly the significant piece of law. That's a general question. Say, I was talking to someone, and sometimes as a practice, you find that particularly private or personal liability companies, I think according to the current definition, individuals or family-based companies, they would include house bonds, personal vehicle expenses, interest rate loans, and part of the expenses as a result of that, then finances become an expressed as negative. To what extent is this piece of legislation addressing those things? Because I maintain that distorts the picture of the company, because things that were supposed to be done private or expressed separate from the financial statement of the company, cushioned in the finances of a business. As a result, people are able to avoid taxes and things. I also just provoking that question there, whether that falls within the piece of legislation or whether it's something that falls under technical law or whatever. But it just struck me, because I think amongst other things, those are the things that as a matter of fact, best practices in conducting business are in fact distortion, if not actually bluntly illegal.
Thank you, Committee. You know, Parliament vests a number of powers in chairpersons. I'm going to utilize one of those now. Tea time for 15 minutes. You know, I do appreciate the fact that a chairperson's responsibilities are varied. They include ensuring that those who slept in hotels should be able to go and sleep there in somebody's hotel cart, unless you want to sleep on the pavement tonight. I will not reveal that it was brought by a very beautiful lady.
Yeah.